Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and features is designed for English learners. So we speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. On the show today, we hear a segment of another What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. And we close the show, as always, with an American story. Later, I'll also tell you about an historical drama out in many movie theaters now. But first, here is Phil Dierking with some medical news.
American health officials recently approved the first gene therapy treatment for an inherited disease, the type that can pass from parent to child. The treatment improves the sight of patients suffering from a genetic mutation that destroys their ability to see. It is the first gene therapy approved where a corrective gene is given directly to patients. People with the disease usually start losing their sight before they are 18. This often progresses to total blindness. The gene that causes the disease could suddenly appear when a child is born with a copy of the gene from both parents. Only a few thousand people in the U.S. are thought to have the condition. Patients receive the therapy, called Luxturna, through two injections, one for each eye. These replace the problem gene that prevents the retina, a tissue at the back of the eye, from changing light into electronic signals sent to the brain. Misty Lovelace received one of the early treatments. She said, "One of the best things I've ever seen since surgery are the stars. I never knew that they were little dots that twinkled." Drug maker Spark Therapeutics has not set the price for the treatment. Its own research, however, has put the value of the therapy at around $1 million. The company says the reason for the high price is due to their prediction that Luxturna will be given only once, with lasting positive effects. To date, the company has researched patients in a study for as long as 4 years and has not seen their vision worsen. The Food and Drug Administration has approved 3 gene therapies since August. The 2 other treatments are specially designed treatments for forms of blood cancer. The approval marks an important growth for a field of study that has struggled with safety concerns. In 1999, a patient treated for a rare metabolic disorder at the University of Pennsylvania died. In another case, patients treated for an immune disorder later developed leukemia. Dr. David Valley said, "The excitement about the possibilities for genetic medicine create opportunities for research on individual diseases." University of Pennsylvania researcher Dr. Jean Bennett said she and her husband, Dr. Albert McGuire, first imagined using genetic medicine to treat retinal blindness in the mid-1980s. But it took many years to develop the science and technology. The first animal tests happened in 2000, and the first human tests in 2007. We didn't know what genes caused the disease. We didn't have animal models with those genes. We didn't have the ability to clone genes and deliver them to the retina. So it took time to develop all that, said Bennett. I'm Phil Dierking.
Darkest Hour is a new historical drama from filmmaker Joe Wright. The movie shows how Winston Churchill urged the British people to fight against Nazi Germany during World War II. Although the movie is based on facts, it seems more like a political action film.
The Germans have encircled 60 British and French divisions. We are looking at the collapse of Western Europe within the next few days.
In the spring of 1940, the West was losing the war against Nazi Germany. The Nazis had invaded Belgium and France. Britain was on the edge of surrender. As the British forces were trapped in the French coastal town of Dunkirk, the British Parliament removed Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain from office. Chamberlain had been seeking a political agreement with Hitler to avoid fighting. The lawmakers replaced him with Winston Churchill, who supported war against the Nazis. Ben Mendelsohn plays George VI.
Why have I been forced to send for Churchill? This record is a catastrophe.
Churchill's unpredictable and explosive personality did not win him many friends. The king himself did not support Churchill at first.
Your Majesty,
it is my duty to invite you to take up the position of Prime Minister of this United Kingdom.
The film uncovers Churchill's qualities as a fierce leader who battled his fears and led Britain to victory against the Nazis. Kristin Scott Thomas plays Churchill's wife, Clementine. Gary Oldman is Churchill.
You have the full weight of the world on your shoulders.
Are you not afraid?
Most terribly.
The film's director, Joe Wright, says Churchill's humanity appealed to him.
It was the element of doubt. The idea that his doubt was a key element to the attainment of wisdom.
Gary Oldman says he was not immediately sure he should accept the part of Churchill. For one thing, the former leader was physically very different from the actor.
I studied the footage and what started to emerge was this rather vital, cherubic, cheeky man who was just a dynamic and full of life, charismatic and funny.
One powerful politician urges Churchill to negotiate peace, arguing that Britain is facing defeat on land, destruction of its army, and invasion.
And before our forces are wiped out completely, now is the time to negotiate.
Oldman, as Churchill, answers.
When will the lesson be learned? When will the lesson be learned? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
Darkest Hour has received generally good reviews, but almost all critics have highly praised Gary Oldman as Churchill. They have called the actor's performance tremendous, fascinating, and phenomenal.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender!
Most say Oldman will win the 2018 Best Actor Oscar for the work. On What It Takes this week, former college basketball coach John Wooden. Here is podcast host Alice Winkler.
Back in October, we featured an interview with Duke University's Mike Krzyzewski, better known as Coach K, and I promised at the end of that episode that come March Madness, I would devote an episode to the words and wisdom of another legendary college basketball coach. Some might call him the college basketball coach, the archetype, the one who inspired the next generation of coaches, including Mike Krzyzewski, the one who won more NCAA championships than any other, the first one voted into the Basketball Hall of Fame twice, once as a player and once as a coach, John Wooden.
The definition I coined for success is peace of mind, attained only through self-satisfaction in knowing you made the effort to become the best of which you're capable. Now, we're all equal there. We're not all equal as far as intelligence is concerned. We're not equal as far as size. We're not equal as far as appearance. We do not all have the same opportunities. We're not born in the same environments. But we're all absolutely equal in having the opportunity to make the most of what we have, not comparing or worrying about what others have.
This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler, and I am keeping my promise. I think UCLA fans in particular could use the healing balm of a Coach Wooden episode to help them think about the glory days when the Bruins were mighty, and it was just a given that they would play in the NCAA tournament. But if Coach Wooden were alive today, he would never berate the current team. He was far too gentlemanly for that. I imagine he would give them compassionate and firm words and a reminder of the cornerstones of his famous pyramid of success. And he might make them all sit on the bench in their bare feet.
The first day that you go to play for Coach Wooden, he tells you about how to put your socks on. And the reason that he does that is because his system requires that you do everything on the run.
That is the voice of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, one of the greatest NBA players of all time, and like John Wooden, a member of the Academy of Achievement.
You don't jog through things. You have to run full speed. And the wear and tear on your feet is immediate and intense. And if your socks aren't on right, if you have like a ridge and that you're running over in your sock, you're going to get a blister, and then you won't be able to practice. And if you don't practice for Coach Wooden, you don't play. So he was telling everybody how to survive his system and get through it without coming up with the blisters on their feet.
Wooden's interview with the Academy was recorded in 1996 when he was 85 years old. He was long retired at that point, but still living by the aphorisms that he passed on to his students for more than four decades. Many of his favorites originated with his dad.
Like Mark Twain, when I was young, I probably didn't appreciate my father at all. But in thinking back to some of the things that that he did that became so meaningful, which he didn't realize at the time. For example, he tried to get across to us, never try to be better than someone else. Learn from others and never cease trying to be the best you can be at whatever you're doing. It don't make a difference what it is. Just try to be the best you can possibly be. If you get yourself too engrossed or concerned in regard to the things over which you have no control, it's going to adversely affect the things over which you have control. And then when I graduated from the small country grade school in the eighth grade, he gave me this little card, and all he said was, son, try to live up to this. And on one side was a verse that said that four things a man must learn to do if he would make his life more true: to think without confusion clearly, to love his fellow man sincerely, to act from honest motives purely, to trust in God and heaven securely. And on the other side was a seven-point creed that I say I've tried to live up to. I haven't, but I'm weak times. But one was be true to yourself, help others, make friendship a fine art, drink deeply from good books, make each day your masterpiece, build a shelter against a rainy day by the life you live, and give thanks for your blessings and pray for guidance every day. Well, just graduated from the eighth grade. That little card, somehow, I kept it with me. until it completely worn out, but I have it. I carry it around in a car, the same thing now, and always have it with me. Not the one that the original that Dad gave me, because it just simply wore out. But my father was a good person, and I owe so much to my dad.
To hear the whole podcast, go to the What It Takes section on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. In honor of the Christmas holiday, we bring you the O. Henry story, The Gift of the Magi. Here is Shep O'Neill.
$1.87, that was all. And 60 cents of it in the smallest pieces of money. Pennies. Pennies saved one and two at a time by negotiating with the men at the market who sold vegetables and meat. Negotiating until one's face burned with the silent knowledge of being poor. 3 times Della counted it. $1.87. And the next day would be Christmas. There was clearly nothing to do but sit down and cry. So Della cried. Which led to the thought that life is made up of little cries and smiles, with more little cries than smiles. Della finished her crying and dried her face. She stood by the window and looked out, unhappily, at a gray cat walking along a gray fence in a gray backyard. Tomorrow would be Christmas Day. And she had only $1.87 to buy her husband Jim a gift. She had been saving every penny she could for months, with this result. Jim earned $20 a week, which does not go far. Expenses had been greater than she had expected. They always are. Many a happy hour she had spent planning to buy something nice for him, something fine and rare, something close to being worthy of the honor of belonging to Jim. There was a tall glass mirror between the windows of the room. Suddenly, Della turned from the window and stood before the glass mirror and looked at herself. Her eyes were shining. But her face had lost its color within 20 seconds. Quickly she pulled down her hair and let it fall to its full length. Now, Mr. and Mrs. James Dillingham Young had 2 possessions which they valued. One was Jim's gold timepiece, the watch that had been his father's and his grandfather's. The other was Della's hair. Had the Queen of Sheba lived in their building, Della would have let her hair hang out the window to dry, just to reduce the value of the Queen's jewels. So now Della's beautiful hair fell about her, shining like a brown waterfall. It reached below her knees and made itself almost like a covering for her. And then quickly she put it up again. She stood still while a few tears fell on the floor. She put on her coat and her old brown hat. With a quick motion and brightness still in her eyes, she danced out the door and down the street. Where she stopped, the sign read, Madame Sofronie, hair goods of all kinds. Della ran up the steps to the shop, out of breath. Will you buy my hair? Asked Della. I buy hair, said Madame. Take your hat off, and let us have a look at it. Down came the beautiful brown waterfall of hair. $20, said Madame, lifting the hair with an experienced hand. Give it to me quick, said Della. The next 2 hours went by as if they had wings. Della looked in all the stores to choose a gift for Jim. She found it at last. It surely had been made for Jim and no one else. It was a chain, simple round rings of silver. It was perfect for Jim's gold watch. As soon as she saw it, she knew that it must be for him. It was like him, quiet and with great value. She gave the shopkeeper $21, and she hurried home with the 87 cents that was left. When Della arrived home, she began to repair what was left of her hair. The hair had been ruined by her love and her desire to give a special gift. Repairing the damage was a very big job. Within 40 minutes, her head was covered with tiny round curls of hair that made her look wonderfully like a schoolboy. She looked at herself in the glass mirror long and carefully. If Jim does not kill me before he takes a second look at me, she said to herself, he'll say I look like a song girl. But what could I do, oh, what could I do with $1.87? At 7 o'clock that night, the coffee was made, and the pan on the back of the stove was hot and ready to cook the meat. Jim was never late coming home from work. Della held the silver chain in her hand and sat near the door. Then she heard his step, and she turned white for just a minute. She had a way of saying a little silent prayer about the simplest everyday things. And now she whispered, "Please, God, make him think I am still pretty." The door opened and Jim stepped in. He looked thin and very serious. Poor man, he was only 22, and he had to care for a wife. He needed a new coat and gloves to keep his hands warm. Jim stopped inside the door, as immovable as a dog smelling a bird. His eyes were fixed upon Della. There was an expression in them that she could not read, and it frightened her. It was not anger, nor surprise, nor fear, nor any of the feelings that she had been prepared for. He simply looked at her with a strange expression on his face. Della went to him. "Jim, my love," she cried, "do not look at me that way. I had my hair cut and sold because I could not have lived through Christmas without giving you a gift. My hair will grow out again. I just had to do it. My hair grows very fast. Say Merry Christmas, Jim, and let us be happy. You do not know what a beautiful, nice gift I have for you." "You have cut off your hair?" asked Jim, slowly, as if he had not accepted the information, even after his mind worked very hard. "Cut it off and sold it," said Della. "Do you not like me just as well? I am the same person without my hair, right?" Jim looked about the room as if he were looking for something. "You say your hair is gone?" he asked. "You need not look for it," said Della. "It is sold, I tell you, sold and gone too. It is Christmas Eve, boy. be good to me, for it was cut for you. Maybe the hairs of my head were numbered, she went on with sudden serious sweetness, but nobody could ever count my love for you. Shall I put the meat on, Jim? Jim seemed to awaken quickly and put his arms around Della. Then he took a package from his coat and threw it on the table. Do not make any mistake about me, Del, he said. I do not think there is any haircut that could make me like my girl any less. But if you will open that package, you may see why you had me frightened at first. White fingers quickly tore at the string and paper. There was a scream of joy, and then, alas, a change to tears and cries, requiring the man of the house to use all his skill to calm his wife. For there were the combs, the special set of objects to hold her hair that Della had wanted ever since she saw them in a shop window. Beautiful combs made of shells, with jewels at the edge, just the color to wear in the beautiful hair that was no longer hers. They cost a lot of money, she knew, and her heart had wanted them without ever hoping to have them. And now the beautiful combs were hers, but the hair that should have touched them was gone. But she held the combs to herself, and soon she was able to look up with a smile and say, "My hair grows so fast, Jim." Then Della jumped up like a little burned cat and cried, "Oh, oh!" Jim had not yet seen his beautiful gift. She happily held it out to him in her open hands. The silver chain seemed so bright. "Isn't it wonderful, Jim? I looked all over town to find it. You will have to look at the time 100 times a day now. Give me your watch. I want to see how it looks on it." Instead of obeying, Jim fell on the couch and put his hands under the back of his head and smiled. "Del," said he, "let us put our Christmas gifts away and keep them a while. They are too nice to use just right now. I sold my gold watch to get the money to buy the set of combs for your hair. And now, why not put the meat on?" The Magi were wise men, wonderfully wise men, who brought gifts to the baby Jesus. They invented the art of giving Christmas gifts. Being wise, their gifts were wise ones. And here I have told you the story of two young people who most unwisely gave for each other the greatest treasures of their house. But in a last word to the wise of these days, let it be said that of all who give gifts, these two were the wisest. Everywhere they are wisest. They are the Magi.
That was Shep O'Neill with the American story, The Gift of the Magi, by O. Henry. We have come to the end of today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you will tune in then. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.